Okay, we ended last time with the story of Rabbi Yochanan. He came to visit Rabbi Elazar. When he entered the room, Rabbi Elazar was lying sick in a dark room. Rabbi Yochanan entered the room, saw that it was dark. He pulled up his sleeve, and his arm illuminated the room. And he saw that Rabbi Elazar weeping. So after he asked him, "Are you weeping about this and are you weeping about that?" Finally, Rabbi Elazar said, "No, I'm not weeping because anything that has to do with me. It's not because I feel inadequate with my learning. It's not because of my parnassus struggles. It's because of this beauty that's going to rot in the ground," referring to Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan, as we noted, was known as one of the most beautiful people in existence in his time. Rabbi Yochanan said, "If that's what you're crying about, you're right." And he joined him. They both wept. So I just want to give that a little bit of perspective. As we mentioned last time, just hearing a description, if we put together pieces from around Shas, a description of Rabbi Yochanan's features would not necessarily conjure in our mind a picture of beauty. He was a very heavy person. His beard didn't grow well. And, what's that? Wispy. And if you just have those points in mind, it's hard to picture a person who was beautiful in a once-in-a-generation kind of level. But yet he was. So, and the truth is that there is such a thing as a person's inside shining through to the outside. The truth is that we can put this into a deeper perspective. I'm kind of going to draw off what the Ben Ish Chai says, although I'm not going to put it into his Kabbalistic terms. But basically, the point is that the more a person connects to his neshama, the more the neshama manifests on the outside too. That's a pasuk in Mishlei, Chochmas Adam Toyer Panav. A person's wisdom, it causes his face to shine. There were very great people in the past that simply looking at them was a pleasure. Now, when they ended up concluding that it's this beauty that's going to rot in the ground that Rabbi Elazar was weeping about, and they both wept together. So here also, I want to give a little bit of perspective on this. What was it that they were weeping about? At the end of the day, isn't the body nothing? And the answer is that the body most certainly is not nothing. The body is a very, very inherent part of the person as a whole. And it's really a part of the team. Of the neshama, the ruach, the nefesh. The body is a part of that team. And when the body is elevated, when the neshama is brought to rule over the body and the body becomes subject to the neshama, the body mamish is a kli kodesh. And therefore, yes, it is true. The fact that a body of an oved Hashem like Rabbi Yochanan, who actually elevated his body to the extent that it reflected his divine level, the fact that that should rot in the ground is tragic. Now I want to address that on a couple of levels, just things that we can come away with from this on a practical level. So first of all, just in a technical way, the Maharsha says that his beauty really was not so personal as much as the fact that he was what remained from the old glory of Yerushalayim. Let's see, people in the time of the Beis HaMikdash were just of a completely different nature than what we know the human being to be. We think that what we know human beings to be, that's basically what the human being is. Sometimes we have no idea of the greatness of generations that we never actually saw. Reb Shlomo Freifeld, I like to quote this, Reb Shlomo Freifeld had in his sukkah hanging a bunch of pictures of Dolim from pre-war Europe. So somebody came in, was sitting in his sukkah, he asked, "Who are these people?" So Reb Shlomo Freifeld says, "These are from the last members of a species that went extinct, the human species." That was how he put it. The truth is, a human being is not what we know it. You hear people say, okay, at the end of the day, everybody's human. Well, Chazal say that yes and no. It could be that the Tanoim were human, but then we have to relate to ourselves as donkeys. Or, it could be that we're human, but then we have to relate to them as malachim, meaning we're really talking about a completely different reality. And that was actually, people who knew these people saw it on them. Their countenance was awe-inspiring. Rabbi Yochanan was one of the last people who still carried that countenance of the old Yerushalayim. And therefore, Rabbi Elazar was saying, when you die, it's going to be an era gone, finished. The end of an era. It will mark a drop. Yiridas Adairis, in the sense that people now are no longer going to be exposed to the old thing, to what used to be. That is very, very tragic. That's very tragic. But we really don't have, we barely have a concept of the greatness of the great individuals from right before the war, from 100 years ago. Right? When we're talking about further back and further back and further back, these are people who mamish defy our concept of a human being, and the fact that we cannot relate to it is a big shame. Because if we were to know one of these people, it would mamish broaden our frame of reference in a very, very big way. Now, lemaisa, that is part of Hashem's plan, that spirituality does deteriorate. But at the end of the day, it's tragic. That's what they were weeping about. In fact, the Goyin says that the fact that this beauty rots in the ground is actually a part of the Golus HaShchinah. These people's bodies, these people's countenance, we could be the same thing on a different level. Hail with base. These people's countenance actually reflects divinity. And therefore, when that rots in the ground, that is divinity rotting in the ground. That is part of the tragedy of the Golus HaShchinah, of the fact that the Shechinah is in Golus. That's why, ultimately, these bodies will be restored. The bodies are a very important part of the picture. By Tchiyas HaMeisim, they will be restored. They're not just nothing. And the fact that in the interim they do rot is tragic. What's that? Rav Shlomo is asking, aren't we told that the goop of the body of a tzaddik doesn't rot in the ground? We've heard such stories. At the end of the day, I'm not sure how the rules with these things work. First of all, we do have to assume the assumption that bodies rot. If we hear about an exception to the rule is that bodies rot. In fact, it's an important part of the process for the neshama state in the upper world. I don't know how to relate to the stories about the exceptions to the rule, but even if we'll say that, no, the standard is that a tzaddik's body does not rot, nevertheless, dying is already rotting to a certain extent. The person's face, the person's body loses its glow. It loses its, when you look at a dead person's eyes, with his eyes open, it's dull. It doesn't have the same vitality that it had when it was alive. That's already a form of rotting. Okay, so we would put that into perspective. Now, it's just important to note another point also. This is also something that we should actually take home for ourselves. Man is created b'tzelem elikim. Tzelem elikim means about a million things. And in many levels, Tzelem Elokim has nothing to do with your physical body. But on a simple, basic level, it does. Man's face somehow reflects the Shechinah. And the fact that every person has a different face reflects the fact that every person is a Gilui of the Shechinah in a different way. The Shechinah is revealing itself through you in a way that was never revealed before in history. That's why no two people have had the same face. And therefore, that's another reason why, yes, a human face rotting is a sacrilege. It's tragic. It's another revelation of the Shechinah that's rotting in the ground. Rachmanu Litzlan. That is how it is. But the Lamaisa, we have to take a couple of things home from this point. First of all, you have to realize, it's like the Gemara says about Hillel. When Hillel went to wash his face. He said, I'm going to engage in kvoid koini. I'm going to engage in Hashem's honor. By washing your face is a representation of the Shekhinah. It's a reflection of the Shekhinah. And like we saw before, you should be able to channel divinity through your face. And therefore your face has to be kept in a very good state. In fact, Rav Avigdor Miller said, this is mamish amazing. Rav Avigdor Miller said that in Slabodka, they worked very hard. They considered it a sacrilege for a person to make a funny face. Face is meant to express the greatness of man all the time. Your countenance, the look on your face. He said in Slabodka, he would watch his rabbein. They were very makbid on that. You wouldn't see their faces expressing anything other than serenity, human greatness. You didn't see exhaustion on their face. You never saw a grimace. A distorted face would be considered a sacrilege. Now again, we're talking very high levels here. But the point is very relevant for us also. The truth is also that we have to learn to relate to others in the same way also. You have to look around at another Jew and be awed by the fact that you are actually seeing the Shekhinah being revealed in a certain way through that Jew. You have to relate with reverence to every Jewish face. Even more than that, Rabbi Avigdor Miller used to say, you can use the human face to practice Shivisi Hashem L'Negdi Samin. You see a person looking at you, you're self-conscious. Use that to picture the Shekhinah looking at you. When you see a person looking at you, why are you self-conscious? How come if there's a cat watching you, you don't feel self-conscious at all? It's obviously not the eyes. Even though it's the eyes that intimidate you, why is it? It's because you know that there's intellect behind the eyes watching you, following you, taking it in, drawing conclusions, right? Someone's watching you walk around, you feel self-conscious. Why? What does he think of me? So when you get used to focusing on that a little bit, thinking of behind those eyes there's an intellect watching, now take it to the next step. There's always an intellect watching. You are always being analyzed by a superior intelligence. It's always being taken in. This again is expressed through the idea of, yes, the kedusha of the human face. Okay, now we'll learn some Gemara. The last narrow line. One more incident on the subject of Yisurim, and with that we tie up the subject. Rav Huna tkifulei arba mi'adoni dechamrim. Rav Huna had 400 barrels of wine that went sour. Big financial loss. Ali Gaber Rav Yehuda Achved Rav Salah Chasidah. Rav Yehuda, the brother of Rav Salah, the pious, came to him. V'rabbanon came to him together with a company of sages. Others say it was Rav Ada Bar Av and other sages. Amrulei, they told him, they were very frank with him. They knew who they were dealing with. They told him, La'ayin ma b'milei. You have to check yourself out. What'd you do wrong? Again, as we said, this is not the thing to come and tell a person. You walk into a shiva house, that's not the thing to say. It's not what you come to say when you're visiting a person who's suffering. But these people knew who they were dealing with. They knew that they were dealing with Rav Huna. They knew that he would appreciate this. They knew that this was the way to relate to him. And as we'll see soon, they actually had something a specific message in mind for him. Omalu. So they told him, no, this happened. You have to check yourself out. Omalu who? So he told them, Omichashin nebeinaychu? Do you suspect me of something? Omrulei. So they told him, well, Michashid kud shabrichu da avidina beloidina? Would Hashem mete out judgment for nothing? So he told them, okay, I surrender, but I'm not aware of anything. So If anybody heard anything about me, let me know. I'm open. Here's your chance. Amule, they answered, Hachi Shmialo. We did hear something. Here's what we heard. Avon had a sharecropper tending to his vineyards. And the sharecropper was entitled to a share not only of the grapes, but of the twigs, of the wood. He said, we heard that you withheld his share of the twigs. Omar Lahu. So he said, yeah, but that's for good reason. Mikashavikli midimine. Does he leave me anything? He's busy stealing from my crops all the time. He's entitled to a 30% share of the fruit. He takes 70%. He's robbing me all the time. I get a little bit back by withholding the twigs. Amule. So they answered, no, this is where you were wrong. Hainu da amri inchi. This is where the expression goes. You're right. You were stealing from a robber. You're just trying to take back what's coming to you. But basagan veganun, a person who steals after a robber, meaning if you rob a robber, time to time, maybe halachically you didn't actually steal, but you've gotten the taste of geneva. For you, that's not a good idea. Meaning, may have been halachic sanction, maybe not, maybe yes, but whatever it is, a person like you should never taste the taste of geneva. Omar Luhu, so he answered them, Kabilne alay diayivnale. Okay? I commit to give it back to him. I'm going to give it back. I accept. Ikadam. So now, what happened? What was the end of the story? Two versions. Some say, Hoda chale v'havacham. All that wine, the 400 barrels of wine that turned into vinegar, turned back into wine. Open miracle. Ve'ikeda amri. Others say, Ayakel chale. No, that's not what happened. It wasn't an open miracle. But the price of vinegar went up. Ve'izdamim bidmei dechamri. And he sold it for the same price as wine. Meaning, his loss was restored in some form or the other. The question is, was it an open miracle of the vinegar turning back into wine? Or no, the price simply went up and he made the same money on the vinegar as he would have made on wine. Okay.
All the barrels were open, actually, all vinegar. So could he just one of the barrels that were open and then the other one was wine?
Apparently he didn't know. I mean, we see that he did go through this experience of having 400 barrels turn into vinegar. Okay. Well, the thing is that Stan is asking, what was the geneva here? Was he actually taking back things that he was really entitled to? So let's understand. What happened was, the sharecropper was stealing grapes. In return, Rav Huna withheld twigs. The sharecropper was taking more than his share of grapes. Vines, meaning the grapes, the produce. Right? So Rav Huna, apparently he was helpless to stop that. What he was able to do, I don't know what the technicalities of the case were, what he was able to do was withhold twigs. So, the sharecropper was entitled to 30% of the grapes. He took 70. So Rav Huna said, alright, you're entitled to 30% of the twigs, I'm going to keep them all for myself. And that way I'll repay myself, at least to an extent. He wasn't taking anything more than the guy had stolen from him, but he wasn't just taking back those grapes. The ganiv was taking from here, and he was taking from the ganiv from there. Oh, good. Okay. Good. So, So I'm gonna repeat what you said. The poskim make a whole challenge out of this. They want to infer what exactly is the halacha What exactly is the halacha being stated here? They do understand that there's actually a halachic issue going on here. The Rav Huna was not allowed to take what he took. So the Tumim says, Shabbanus and Ibishitz, he says, it's basically exactly the point that you just made, as follows. He says, if Rav Huna, if that guy stole grapes, and Rav Huna would have stolen those grapes back, that would be fine. That would definitely be fine. But the thing here is that he didn't actually take what was his. In place, the sharecropper took my grapes, I'm going to substitute it for the twigs that are coming to him. That, the Tumim says, was the problem here. That is not allowed. Even though there is a rule that a person, avidinish dinal enafshe, a person can take the law into his own hands. There's a lot of buts there, okay? Don't take that as halakha l'maisa. I'm just saying in a general way. Rav Huna would have been allowed to take the law into his own hands in this case. But that's only if he would actually take back those very grapes. To take from somewhere else, right? He stole my money, so I'm going to come take his socks. That's not allowed. That you're not entitled to that. You're entitled to your belongings. What can I do? Go to Beis Din. Go to Beis Din. But to go ahead on your own and take other things of his, you're not allowed to do.
Not to take his socks, but to take his money.
What's that?
Take his money.
Oh, so no. If the person took money from you, you can take money from him in the circumstances where it's legitimate to take the law into your own hands, which is a complicated subject. But if he took grapes from you, you cannot take his money. Only through Beis Din. You can take those grapes back.
Would it have to be the same money?
Would it have to be the same physical money? If he steals money from you, can you take back other bills? I don't know how that works. I don't know. Okay. Fine. By the way, I'll just bring out another point here. Was Rav Huna allowed to tell the Chachamim this? The Chachamim asked him, "Why are you taking twigs from your share? Why are you withholding the twigs from your sharecropper?" Rav Huna answered, "Do you know what the guy took from me?" Was he allowed to say that? What's that? So the Chafetz Chaim addresses this question. You're on target. The Chafetz Chaim addresses this question. Who should address this if not the Chafetz Chaim? The Chafetz Chaim addresses this question, and he says, basically, this is a general question. Someone suspects you of doing something wrong. Can you explain things by shifting the blame over to somebody else when it's true? Are you allowed to do that? To clear your name. Yeah, can you explain that it was really somebody else in order to clear your name? An interesting practical example of this came up. The question is to Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein. The neighbors were talking about Mr. Goldberg, that he was acting disgusting. Why? He used to come once a week and hang a bag of garbage on Mr. Friedman's door. Cigarette butts, shells of seeds, tissues. He would hang a bag of trash on Mr. Friedman's door. And the neighbors started talking about it. Now, you know why he was doing that? He was doing that because Mr. Friedman lived above him, and these were things that were regularly dropping from Friedman's porch onto his. And he asked Friedman a few times, "Please buy an ashtray. Keep your trash on your own porch." But Friedman kept dropping things onto Goldberg's porch. So Goldberg decided he's going to collect it. Like we just said before, he's going to give him back exactly what belongs to him. Collected it in a bag and hung it on the guy's door. Hashalat Aved, exactly. And then the neighbors started talking about Goldberg. And Friedman made a self-righteous, suffering face. "Look what Goldberg is doing to me." So the answer is that yes. If there isn't a way to clear your name without saying what happened, you're allowed to do so. That's the only out you have. And therefore, yes, Rav Huna was allowed to do it, Goldberg is allowed to do it, and in other such situations where people suspect you of wrongdoing because of somebody else's wrongdoing, if you have no other way of getting around it, you are allowed to clear your name by explaining that it's the other guy. But there is one more condition. That is, if it will not result in this guy being punished or something like that in a way that exceeds the bounds of halacha. Meaning, if you're telling what the other guy did will cause somebody to report him and he'll get in more trouble than he should get in al-pi halacha, then it's not allowed in any case. Okay, that's that. I think he was mafkir it. He doesn't mind if you keep it. You're going to say something? Okay. All right. We'll move on. Oh, the Reuven is asking a good question. You know what Rabbi said? Let's see a Tosfos. You see the Tosfos that says Dina Beloy Dina. Let's see that inside. Dina Beloy Dina, right? The Chachamim told him, how could you say I'm innocent? Would Hashem mete out judgment for nothing? So Reuven is asking, 1 minute, we just saw a whole sugya of Yisurim Me'ava. Why couldn't Rav Huna say Yisurim Me'ava? I'm being mechaper for the whole generation. So Taisa says, Har beit tzadikim yesh. There are plenty of absolute tzadikim sheloikim begufam ubebemoinam, that suffer misfortune on the physical and on the financial level, not as a result of an avera. And if so, why were they coming and saying there must be something because Hashem wouldn't do it for nothing? That isn't true. Elohim ha-yoyidim. The reason that they came and told him this was really just in order to get this out of him. They knew that he was doing this. That was really why they came. Of course there's such a thing as a person suffering without having sin. But their point really was to come and rebuke him for this. And that was why they hinted at it in this way. They knew that he was withholding the twigs from his sharecropper. And in this way they were trying to hint to him that he himself should pick up that what he's doing is incorrect. But really, if not for this, they wouldn't have said that. Because yes, it's quite possible that Hashem would mete out judgment, not as a punishment. Okay, but you know what the Ben Ish Chai says? He says, "Know what they told? Exactly the words that they told him." You just reminded me of this. They didn't say, "Look at your dvarim." La'ayim mar bimilei. That was the words that they used. Literally, that translates as, "Check out your words." Who was it that said earlier that if a person has yisurim, he should check his ways? Rav Huna. This same Rav Huna. They came and they told him, "Check your own words." So he told them, "Michashidne be'enaychu." Ben Ish Chai says this was actually the dialogue. He said, "You suspect me of not keeping my own teaching? Of course I checked my ways, and I came up with nothing." So then they told him, they hinted at what they were hinting at. Good. Okay. No. If I lend somebody money and I come and collect, I'm not taking revenge. I want my money back. Getting your money back is not revenge. Okay. Let's. He held it was okay. But when they told him that no, he accepted. Yeah. Okay. What? That's not revenge. If someone steals something from me and I try to get it back, that's not revenge. That's getting back your money. Okay, we move on. We're finished with the subject of Yisurin for the time being. Now let's hope that we're all really finished with it. Tanya, new subject. Abba Binyamin Oimer, Al Shnei Dvorim Hoyisi Mitzta'er Kol Yomai. I would trouble myself over two issues all my days. I would always make sure, even at personal expense, that my tefillah should be before my bed. What does that mean? We don't know yet. We'll assume right now that it means that he was very makpid to daven in front of his bed. We'll translate it literally. That's number one. He would do this all the time, even at personal expense. And number two was, Valmitasi shetehein nisuna bein tzafan ledarim. Number two, I would always make sure that my bed is situated between north and south. Two, not such clear precepts that he said that he always kept, even at great self-sacrifice. And we need to clarify both. So we'll start with the first. Atfilasi shetehein lifnei mitasi. First was, I always made sure, sacrifice, even at self-sacrifice, that I should daven in front of my bed. So the Gemara says, my lifnei mitasi, what does he mean? I should daven before my bed. Ilema lifnei mitasi mamish? Did he mean that literally? For some reason, he would always make sure to daven in front of his bed? That was his place for davening? The Omar of Yehuda Omar of Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, the Tamer Rabbi Yishua ben Levi, or it may have been Rabbi Yishua ben Levi, one of those who said, Minayin lemispalel shelo yehei dovo choytzeitz beinoy levein akir. How do we know that when a person davens, there should be nothing between him and the wall? You should be directly exposed to the wall. Good, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. Shenema, as it says in the Pasuk, Vayasev Chizkiyahu Panav El Akir. When Chizkiyahu davened, when he was sick, how did he daven? He turned his face to the wall. Vayispalo, and he davened. So if so, certainly do not daven in front of your bed. Go around your bed and daven in front of the wall. So the Gemara answers, Loi Tema Lifnei Mitasi. You're right. He didn't mean in front of his bed. Ela Ema Samuch Limitasi. Rather he meant, I daven right near my bed time-wise, meaning as soon as getting out of bed in the morning, I daven, without any lapse of time in between. First thing I do when I get up is daven. So it's close to his bed in the time sense. Okay, so we just learned two halachas here. Let's note that. We just learned two halachas, both of which are halacha lemaisa. Number one, you should not have anything between you and the wall when you daven. Number two, that you should daven close to your bed, meaning as soon as possible after getting out of bed. So let's first address the first, just to put it into practical perspective. Stan asked, if you think about it for a minute, picture any shul, picture any situation in which you daven, there's an awful lot between you and the wall. There are chairs, tables, shtenders, people. Maybe you say, maybe it shouldn't be that way. The Gemara talks about Hadid Chazanim Davin. It was referred to as a person who davened in front of the Aron. Right? That's the classic, that's the Chazan. It's the Aron between you and the wall. What do we do with all this? How is this meant to be understood practically? So, the bottom line halacha, here, okay, I haven't given out sheets in a while, so... Here, if you want if you want the full discussion, you can go through the full discussion. But the bottom line halacha is that there are a couple of qualifications to this rule. First of all, the very fact that we see, people davened by the Aron Kodesh already shows us there's a qualification. So there's a couple of qualifications to this rule. The bottom line is that anything that it only refers to things, first of all, anything that's in a fixed spot, that's a regular fixture, is not a problem. What's the point of this halacha? What's the problem with something between you and the wall? That it'll distract your attention. That's the problem. If there are things around, interesting things going on between you and the wall, going to distract your attention. Someone puts a big movie screen right between you and the wall, how's your Shemoneh Esrei going to be? Oh, no. So, no. as we'll see. So first of all, things that are regular presence are not a problem. That's why an Aron Kodesh. It's a permanent presence. Oh, we'll get to people. But first of all, that's not a problem. That's why the Aron Kodesh is not a problem. Second of all, the Poskim say that it only refers to large things. It doesn't mean a little thing. A sefer or something like that. It means a big, bulky object, which they say 10 tefachim high by 4 tefachim wide. That's what the place can come up with. Only that's a problem. But other little things that are in between you and the wall are not a problem. Now, this still doesn't answer shtenders. A shtender is 10 tefachim high, 4 tefachim wide, and is not a permanent fixture. So that the place can say anything that facilitates the davening is also obviously not a problem. So really, what comes out the bottom line is that it's pretty uncommon to really run into a problem with this. It has to be, maybe if there's a speaker or something, what cases are you going to have of something 10 tefachim high and 4 tefachim wide between you and the wall? If there's a speaker or something like that. The truth is that if you're at home, if you're davening at home, a chair between you and the wall, you should move it out of the way. In shul, that's not a problem because the way the Rashba puts it, anything that's facilitating the shul or the davening. In shul, the chairs are there to facilitate the shul and the davening, and therefore that's not a problem. But at home, yeah, if you are davening at home, it is a good idea to move chairs or other such things out of the way. Now, the next big question is people. People are not permanently fixed in that spot. They are more than 10 tefachim high and 4 tefachim wide, and they also are not facilitating your davening unless you are using him as a shtender. So what about people in your way? What's that? Okay, you picked up on a subtle point. But first I'll just say that in general, the place can say that people are not a problem, essentially. People are not a problem. Yet, since there is a shita that people are a problem, it's a good idea, if possible, to daven at the front of the shul. Now, obviously, not everybody can daven in the front of the shul, and therefore, you really don't have to worry about it too much. If it's easy enough to daven at the front of the shul, daven at the front of the shul. If not, just forget about it. People are not a problem. Now, some place can add, basically what Shlomo just said, that even when we talk about people being a problem, it's only people who are not davening at the time. Someone who's davening at the time is a part of the many, that's a part of the whole experience. So the bottom line, what we would say about that is, generally, you don't really have to worry about people. If it's easy enough to have a front seat, have a front seat. Don't put too much or even much effort into it. It doesn't really matter.
I understand the front wall is ideal.
I'm mainly talking about the front wall. Oh, so bookshelves are permanently in that spot. The books are not big enough to be a problem. So that's okay. The sofa is a permanent fixture. Well, you know what? The truth is not necessarily. If it's a type of sofa that's easily movable, it might be better not to daven in front of the sofa. A table, though, if you're davening on the table, meaning if you have your siddur on the table, it's facilitating your davening. Otherwise, enochanami. So for a table, it might be a good idea to try to avoid davening in front of. Yeah. Now, I'll just give a little bit of a deeper take on this, just in order to appreciate this halacha is not entirely technical. There's a deeper take on this that the Reish Chachma gives. This is actually in a very, very amazing exposition of the Reish Chachma, in which he shows the intense level of intimacy that we reach when we're davening to Hashem. And he says that davening to Hashem is mamish, we don't realize what's going on when we're davening. But he says that it mamish reaches a level that corresponds to the most intimate situation a person will have with his wife. Mamish, the epitome of intimacy is going on when a person's davening. The Reish Chachma expounds on this at length, showing all kinds of halachas that correspond between the two subjects. Very, very amazing piece. And he says that this halacha corresponds there too. When a person is intimate with his wife, there should be nothing in between at all. And therefore, when a person is davening, there should be nothing at all in between. That's the way the Rishis Chachma puts it. The truth is, if we're going with that understanding, I shouldn't really say this because I don't want people to start getting nervous, you know, getting obsessive about this. Halacha is that all the things we discussed, it's fine, right? But if we're talking on this level, then there's room to say that there should mamish be nothing between a person and the wall. Again, that is not the halacha, but there were people who were great people of the past who were makpid on that, again, as a level of extra piety. But it certainly is not the halacha. I wouldn't even say that it's something that you need to do or even recommend it. It's one of those high up there things. As long as we're not being makpid on all the inyanim of Kabbalah, we don't have to rush to do that. But it certainly does give us a deeper understanding of what this halacha represents. And a little bit more of a feel for what's going on when we're actually davening. Okay. Discussion number two was Al tfilasi shtei lifnei mitasi smucha lemitasi. Person, when he wakes up, should daven immediately, first thing. This also is a paskin lahalacha. It's a very fundamental halacha with a lot of very, very practical implications, obviously. So, first of all, what's the idea here? The idea is a couple of things. The way the Maharal puts it, I'll put it into the Maharal's perspective, he, as usual, gives that deeper insight into the way the Gemara puts it. The Gemara later says, simply says that it's sacrilegious to engage in any personal activities before davening. When you get up in the morning, the first thing you do is relate to Hashem. To get busy with your own personal issues before that, it's like telling Hashem, you're on the back burner. Person gets up, deals with Hashem, then goes about his personal activities. What's that? Well, these are all parts of the process of davening.
Gets up in the morning. So he gets up an hour before.
So Stan is asking, the way I'm presenting it, it sounds like you roll out of bed in pajamas to the talis and tefillin. Don't brush your teeth. No anything. What's that? Oh. Sleep with your clothes on. Right. So we have to put this into perspective. So, first of all, obviously, anything that is being done for the davening is not a problem. That's all part of getting ready to daven. Yes, you get up, you go to the bathroom, it's a part of the covet of davening. You wash yourself up, you brush your teeth. These are all part of the covet of davening. But you do have to keep in mind that other things, taka, are a problem. First of all, for example, schmoozing before davening is very strongly discouraged. To call somebody on the phone, if it's not about something quick and technical, is very strongly discouraged. What's that? If your wife wants to talk to you. Well, in a general way, we'll say that usually when your wife is talking to you in the morning, it's pretty technical, getting the kids ready, etc., etc. And we'll address that too in a minute. Getting the kids ready before davening. These types of technical things are technical. Yeah? And also, yeah, okay. As far as really sitting down for a good shmooze before davening, you have to use your seichel. If your wife can appreciate the concept of that we shouldn't really engage in anything serious before I daven, good. If not, be a mensch. But the truth is that it says in halacha that the earlier people would even deviate in the way they greeted people in the morning. Meaning, in general, we know there's an issue with saying shalom before davening, but there are circumstances where it's permitted. Even then, they would make a point of saying it differently, just in order to remain conscious of the idea, I don't want to get involved in socializing right now, I'm on my way to daven. Respond in a menschlich way, but don't get involved in anything. So again, the preparations for davening, etc., obviously are not an issue, but other things, other sorts of activities should be kept to an absolute minimum or skipped. Shopping shouldn't be done before davening, again, unless it's for the things that are needed immediately at home. I saw one of the poskim that says, for example, you need to help get your kids off in the morning, and you need to go get bread and milk for the morning, that's all chesed. It says in halacha, listen to this, this is an amazing idea, I saw one of the priests can say this. It says in halacha that it's meritorious to give tzedakah before davening. Buying bread for hungry children in the morning fulfills that inyan. Okay? So therefore, mitzvah activities are also okay. Mitzvah activities are also okay. But other things, tending to business issues, etc., etc., should not be dealt with before davening. Okay. Here also, when they come in bulk. But if you want the full discussion, you got that here in a separate
thing. The main thing of davening before the wall is the distraction, you mentioned, right?
What's that? Yeah. Yes. You're making a good point. The issue of not davening, not having things between you and the wall. At the end of the day, even if you're davening in the siddur, if there are things going on around you, it will distract you. And therefore, it's best not to have things going on. And in Hanami, if there are things in front of you, it says, when you're in a situation where there's not much you can do about it, close your eyes. But otherwise, when people do daven from a siddur, if there's action around them, or if there are unusual things around them, they're likely to be distracted. But for this very reason, the Rama writes, there should not be pictures in siddurim. Siddurim should not be illustrated. Because what greater distraction is there than that? Oh wow, this looks good. In the middle of Shemana Esrei, you're busy analyzing the picture. So siddurim should not be illustrated for that reason. Here, there's a lot more details to this subject of activities before davening. It's good to see this. There's a lot of practical halacha here. Okay. Right. I mean, hey, we're putting you to work tonight. Shkoyach. Okay. No. This is just for Shabbos. This is just for Shabbos. Immediately upon getting up, you daven. Ah, now that's coming up. Now we come on to the next subject, which is a pretty juicy subject. The issue of the orientation of the bed. The Gemara's interior designing directives. Alright, everybody got? Okay. Emergency is an emergency, yeah. But you see there, it's mamish spelled out, you have pretty full detail about how that works. Okay, now let's see the next point. Now we get on to the last point we mentioned. Bal mitasi shetehei nesuna bein tzofen ledoron. A person's bed should be situated between the north and the south. The Omer Rabbi Chome ber Rabbi Chanina, Omer Rabbi Yitzchok. It's like Rabbi Chome ber Rabbi Chanina said in the name of Rabbi Yitzchok. Kol anoisen mitasi bein tzofen ledoron. A person who positions his head, it's his bed, between north and south, Havin Lebanim Sfarim, he will merit male children. Shenema, as it says in the pasuk, Utzfuncha Temalei Bitna. The literal meaning of this pasuk is, what you have hidden away, your hidden away treasures, you will fill their stomachs with. But we're reading it as Utzfuncha Temalei Bitna. Your north, you'll fill their stomachs with. Stomach meaning pregnancy. Yisbil banim, and they will be satiated with sons. So that's number one. It's a schus for having male children. Av Nachman by Yitzchok said, Afein ishtoi mapeles nefalim. It's also a schus that a person's wife will not miscarry. Ksiv hacha utzfuncho temalei vitnom. Here it says, and you will fill their stomachs with your good. It tells elsewhere, and her days of pregnancy were full, and she had twins, healthy, full pregnancy. What's this directive about? What's that?
Twins.
No, no, but we're learning it from Gzeirus Shaveh from the other pasuk that did give that implication about the north. It's Gzeirus Shaveh. It says here male and here male. Now, what's this idea about? And what's the halacha lemaisa on it? It's a little bit complex. Well, the idea Rashi says that the idea is, since we know that the Shekhinah is generally situated east to west, west to east, a person should not engage in relations in that direction. A person should be going in the other direction when engaging in relations.
How do we know it's from east to west?
The Shekhinah? How do we know that it's from east to west? In general, the Shekhinah is said to be situated with the back to the west, facing east. That's why, for example, the Kodesh HaKadoshim is on the west side.
That's only because we are here. Part of the world that lives in Iran, they always daven to the west.
They daven toward the Kodesh HaKadoshim. But if we're taking the Kodesh HaKadoshim as the focal, as the central point, the Shekhinah is situated to the west. In general, you see many places of Chazal that the Shekhinah is associated with the west side, facing the east side. So that the Shekhinah's range is east to west, west to east. That's why the Beis HaMikdash was situated, many other such things. And therefore, when a person is engaging in marital relations, a person should be north to south. No. What's that?
Where they hang.
So, the Maharal says that there's a little more to this, and we'll see soon that there's a lot more to this. The Maharal says that north to south, it's not just negative in order not to be east to west. He says there's more to it. A person goes to sleep at night. Here again we're seeing another element of what we've been seeing the whole time. A person has to mamish make an avodah of sleeping too. Sleeping is a very important part of your service of Hashem. A person goes to sleep at night, it says that you are entrusting your neshama with Hashem. Now here's an interesting thing, which I'm not going to be able to completely explain, but the Maharal cites sources that the place where Hashem keeps the neshamas is to the north. It's to the north. And therefore, when you go to sleep, you should sleep with your head to the north, showing Hashem. The neshama is most associated with the head. You are consciously entrusting your neshama with Hashem. That's the depth behind this directive of sleeping situated between north and south, which will mean, according to this, that yes, the head should be to the north. Now, I'll just say that before everybody goes home and rearranges their rooms and gets their wives very upset, wait for Sunday, there's more to see on this. We'll see Bezos Hashem. Oh, and again, Bezos Hashem, just for the people who missed it at the beginning of this year, we spoke about having a Hanukkah celebration Tuesday. Not Tuesday, Chas v'Shalom. We shouldn't do it at the expense of a shir. It'll be Be'ezras Hashem next Motzei Shabbos. Next Motzei Shabbos. Chvoid Rabbi Yedidya. You too. Next Motzei Shabbos, Be'ezras Hashem. Second Motzei Shabbos of Hanukkah. At what? The eighth night of Hanukkah. Be'ezras Hashem at my home at 8:30. 62, what? No, no, no. It's the last night of Hanukkah. Yeah. Last night of Hanukkah. 62, the lane 62 of 13, 8:30, Bezos Hashem. Whoever can make it will be very happy to see you.